Fine, then. Let them.
Someone had pulled a window blind, throwing our table into tiger-striped shadow. Reeve, eyeing me smugly, speared a bright orange prawn and ate it.
I mean, I've been trying to think, he said. Maybe you can help me. What other painting of its size would be anywhere near its class? Maybe that lovely little Velasquez, you know, the garden of the Villa Medici. Of course, rarity doesn't even enter into it.
Tell me again, what are we talking about? Because I'm really not sure what you're getting at.
Well, keep it up if you want, he said affably, wiping his mouth with his napkin. You're not fooling anybody. Although I have to say it's pretty bloody irresponsible to entrust it to these goons to handle and pawn around.
At my astonishment, which was perfectly genuine, I saw a blink of what might have been surprise cross his face, but just as quickly it was gone.
People like that can't be entrusted with something so valuable, he said, chewing busily. Street thugs. Ignoramuses.
You are making absolutely no sense, I snapped.
No? He put down the fork. Well, what I'm offering, if you ever care to understand what I'm talking about, is to buy the thing off you.
My tinnitus, old echo of the explosion, had kicked in, as it often did in moments of stress, a high-pitched drone like incoming aircraft.
Shall I name a figure? Well, I think half a million should do nicely, considering that I'm in a position to make a phone call this moment.
He removed his cell phone from his pocket and put it on the table beside his water glass.
And put this enterprise of yours to a stop.
I closed my eyes, then reopened them.
Look, how many times can I say it?
I really don't know what you're thinking, but...
I'll tell you exactly what I'm thinking, Theodore. I'm thinking conservation, preservation, concerns which clearly haven't been paramount for you or the people you're working with. Surely you'll realize it's the wisest thing to do. For you, and for the painting as well. Obviously you've made a fortune, but it's irresponsible, wouldn't you agree, to keep it bouncing around in such precarious conditions?
But my unfeigned confusion at this seemed to serve me well. After a weird, offbeat lag, he reached into the breast pocket of his suit.
Is everything okay?
Said our male model waiter, appearing suddenly.
Yes, yes, fine.
The waiter disappeared, sliding across the room to talk to the beautiful hostess. Reeve, from his pocket, took out several sheets of folded paper, which he pushed across the tablecloth to me. It was a printout of a web page. Quickly I scanned it. FBI, international agencies, botched raid, investigation.
What the fuck is this? I said, so loudly that a woman at the next table jumped.
Reeve, involved in his lunch, said nothing.
No, I mean it. What does this have to do with me?
Scanning the page irritably, wrongful death suit, Carmen Huidobro, housekeeper from Miami Temp Agency, shot dead by agents who stormed the home. I was about to ask again what anything in this article had to do with me, when I stopped cold. An old master painting, once believed destroyed, the Goldfinch, Carol Fabricius, 1654, was employed as rumored collateral in the deal with Contreras, but unfortunately was not recovered in the raid on the South Florida compound. Though stolen artworks are often used as negotiable instruments to supply venture capital for drug trafficking and arms deals, the DEA has defended itself against criticism in what the Art Crimes Division of the FBI has called bungled and amateurish handling of the matter, issuing a public statement apologizing for the accidental death of Mrs. Huidobro, while also explaining that their agents are not trained to identify or recover stolen artwork. In pressured situations such as this, said Turner Stark, spokesman for the DEA press office, our top priority will always be the safety of agents and civilians as we secure the prosecution of major violations of America's controlled substance laws. The ensuing furor
especially in the wake of the suit over Mrs. Huidobro's wrongful death, has resulted in a call for greater cooperation between federal agencies. All it would have taken was one phone call, said Hofstede von Moltke, spokesman for the Art Crimes Division of Interpol, in a press conference yesterday in Zurich. But these people weren't thinking about anything but making their arrest and getting their conviction. And that's unfortunate because now this painting has gone underground, and it may be decades until it's seen again. The trafficking of looted paintings and sculptures is estimated to be a $6 billion industry worldwide. Though the sighting of the painting was unconfirmed, detectives believe that the rare Dutch masterwork has already been whisked out of the country, possibly to Hamburg, where it has likely passed hands at a fraction of the many millions it would raise at auction. I put down the paper. Reeve, who had stopped eating, was regarding me with a tight, feline smile. Maybe it was the primness of that tiny smile in his pear-shaped face, but unexpectedly I burst out laughing. The pent-up laughter of terror and relief, just as Boris and I had laughed when the fat mall cop chasing us and about to catch us slipped on wet tile in the food court and fell smack on his ass.
Yes, said Reeve.
He had an orange stain on his mouth from the prawns, the old jabberwock.
Found something that amuses you?
But all I could do was shake my head and look out across the restaurant. Man, I said, wiping my eyes. I don't know what to say. Clearly, you are delusional, or I don't know. Reeve, to his credit, did not look perturbed, though clearly he wasn't pleased. No, really, I said, shaking my head. I'm sorry, I shouldn't laugh, but this is the most absurd fucking thing I've ever seen. Reeve folded his napkin and put it down.
You're a liar, he said pleasantly. You may think you can bluff your way out of this, but you can't. Wrongful death suit? Florida compound? What, you actually think this has something to do with me?
Reeve regarded me fiercely with his tiny, bright blue eyes.
Be reasonable. I'm giving you a way out.
Way out? Miami, Hamburg. Even the place names made me burst into an incredulous huff of laughter.
Way out of what?
Reeve blotted his lips with his napkin.
I'm delighted you find it so amusing, he said smoothly. Since I'm fully prepared to phone this gentleman at the Art Crimes Division they mention, and tell him exactly what I know about you and James Hobart and this scheme you're running together, what would you say to that?
I threw down the paper, pushed back my chair. I would say, go right ahead and phone him. Be my guest. Whenever you want to talk about the other matter, call me. 15. Momentum spun me out of the restaurant so fast, I hardly noticed where I was going. But as soon as I was 3 or 4 blocks away, I began to shake so violently that I had to stop in the grimy little park just south of Canal Street and sit on a bench, hyperventilating, head between my knees, the armpits of my Turnbull and Asser suit drenched with sweat, looking, I knew, to the surly Jamaican nannies, the old Italians fanning themselves with newspapers and eyeing me suspiciously, like some coked-out junior trader who'd pressed the wrong button and lost 10 million. There was a mom-and-pop drugstore across the street. Once my breathing had settled, I walked over, feeling clammy and isolated in the mild spring breeze, and bought a Pepsi from the cold case, and walked away without taking my change, and went back to the leaf shade of the park, the soot-dusted bench, pigeons aloft and beating, traffic roaring past to the tunnel, other boroughs, other cities, malls and parkways, vast impersonal streams of interstate commerce. There was a great, seductive loneliness in the hum, a summons almost, like the call of the sea. And for the first time I understood the impulse that had driven my dad to cash out his bank account, pick up his shirts from the cleaners, gas up the car, and leave town without a word. Sun-baked highways, twirled dials on the radio, grain silos and exhaust fumes, vast tracts of land unrolling like a secret vice. Inevitably my thoughts went to Jerome. He lived way up on Adam Clayton Powell, a few blocks from the last stop on the 3 line. But there was a bar called Brother J's where we sometimes met on 110th, a working man's dive with Bill Withers on the jukebox and a sticky floor, career alcoholics slumped over their third bourbon at 2 p.m. But Jerome did not sell pharmaceuticals in increments of less than $1,000, and though I knew he would be perfectly glad to let me have a few bags of smack, it seemed like a lot less trouble if I just went ahead and took a cab straight down to the Brooklyn Bridge. Old lady with a chihuahua. Little kids squabbling over a popsicle. Up above canal streamed a remote delirium of sirens, a formal off-stage note that clashed with the ringing in my ears. Something of mechanical warfare about it. Sustained drone of incoming missiles. With my hands pressed over my ears, which didn't help the tinnitus at all, if anything, amplified it, I sat very still and tried to think. My childish machinations about the chest on chest now struck me as ridiculous. I would simply have to go to Hobie and admit what I'd done. Not much fun. Pretty shitty, in fact. But better if he heard it from me. How he would react, I couldn't imagine. Antiques were all I knew. I'd have a hard time getting another job in sales, but I was just handy enough to find a place in a workshop if I had to, gilding frames or cutting bobbins. Restorations didn't pay well, but so few people knew how to repair antiques to any kind of decent standard that someone was sure to take me on. As for the article, I was confused by what I'd read, almost as if I'd walked in on the middle of the wrong movie. On one level, it was clear enough. Some enterprising crook had faked my goldfinch, in terms of size and technique, not all that difficult a piece to fake. And the phony was floating around somewhere being fronted as collateral in drug deals and misidentified by various clueless drug lords and federal agents. But no matter how fanciful or off-base the story, how lacking in relevance to the painting or me, the connection Reeve had made was real. Who knew how many people Hobie had told about me showing up at his house, or how many people those people had told? But so far, no one, not even Hobie, had made the connection that Welty's ring put me in the gallery with the painting. This was the crux of the biscuit, as my father would have said. This was the story that would get me put in jail. The French art thief who'd panicked, who'd burned a lot of the paintings he'd stolen, Cranach, Watteau, Corot, had only gotten 26 months in prison. But that was France, only shortly after 9/11, and under the new rubric of federal anti-terrorism laws, the museum thefts carried an additional, more serious charge of looting of cultural artifacts. Penalties had grown much stiffer, in America particularly, and my personal life didn't stand a lot of scrutiny. Even if I was lucky, I would be looking at 5 to 10 years. Which, if I was honest, I deserved. How had I ever thought I could keep it hidden? I'd meant to deal with the painting for years, get it back where it belonged, and yet somehow I had kept on and on finding reasons not to. To think of it wrapped and sealed uptown made me feel self-erased, blanked out, as if burying it away had only increased its power and given it a more vital and terrible form. Somehow, even shrouded and entombed in the storage locker, it had worked itself free and into some fraudulent public narrative, a radiance that glowed in the mind of the world. 16. Hobie, I said, I'm in a jam. He glanced up from the japanned chest he was retouching, roosters and cranes, golden pagodas on black. Can I help? He was outlining a crane's wing with water-based acrylic, very different from the shellac-based original. But the first rule of restorations, as he taught me early on, was that you never did what you couldn't reverse. Actually, the thing is, I've sort of gotten you in a jam, inadvertently. Well, the line of his brush did not waver. If you told Barbara Gibbery we'd help her with that home she's decorating in Rhinebeck, you're on your own. Colors of the chakras, I never heard of such a thing. No. I tried to think of something funny or easy to say. Mrs. Gibbery, aptly nicknamed Trippy, was usually a wellspring of comedy, but my mind had gone completely blank. Afraid not. Hobie straightened up, stuck the paintbrush behind one ear, blotted his forehead with a wildly patterned handkerchief, psychedelic purple like an African violet had thrown up on it, something he'd found probably in a crazy old lady's effects at one of his sales upstate. "What's going on, then?" he said reasonably, reaching for one of the saucers he mixed his paint in. Now that I was in my 20s, the generational formality between us had vanished, so that we were collegial in a way it was difficult to imagine being with my dad, had he lived. Me, always on edge, trying to figure out how fucked up he was and what my percentage point was of trying to get any kind of straight answer. I reached to make sure that the chair behind me wasn't sticky before I sat. "Hobie, I've made a stupid mistake." "No, a really stupid one," I said, at his good-natured, dismissive gesture. "Well," he was dripping raw umber into the saucer with an eyedropper, "I don't know about stupid, but I can tell you it wholly ruined my day last week to see that drill bit coming through Mrs. Wasserman's tabletop. That was a good William and Mary table. I know she won't see where I've patched the hole, but believe me, it was a bad moment." His half-attentive manner made it worse. Quickly, with a sort of sick, dreamed glide, I rushed headlong into the matter of Lucius Reeve and the chest on chest, leaving out Platt and the backdated receipt in my breast pocket. Once I got started, it was like I couldn't stop, like the only thing to do was keep talking and talking, like some highway killer droning on under a light bulb at a rural police station. At some point, Hobie stopped working, stuck the paintbrush behind his ear. He listened steadily, with a sort of heavy-browed, arctic, ptarmigan settling into itself look that I knew well. Then, he plucked the sable brush from behind his ear and dabbled it in some water before he wiped it on a piece of flannel. "Theo," he said, putting up a hand, closing his eyes. I'd stalled, going on and on about the uncashed check, dead end, bad position. "Stop. I get the picture." "I'm so sorry," I was babbling. "I should never have done it, never, but it's a real nightmare. He's pissed off and vindictive and he seems to have it in for us for some reason. You know, some other reason. Something apart from this." "Well," Hobie removed his glasses. I could see his confusion and just how gingerly he was feeling around in the pause that followed, trying to shape his response. "What's done is done. No point making it worse. But..." He stopped and thought. "I don't know who this guy is. But if he thought that chest was an Affleck, he has more money than sense. To pay $75,000, that's what he gave you for the thing?" "Yes." "Well, he needs his head examined, that's all I can say. Pieces of that quality turn up once or twice in a decade, maybe, and they don't appear on the scene from nowhere." "Yes, but also, any fool knows a real Affleck would be worth much more. Who buys a piece like that without doing their homework? An idiot, that's who. Also," he said, speaking over me, "you did the correct thing once he called you on it. You tried to refund his money, and he didn't take it. That's what you're saying?" "I didn't offer to refund it. I tried to buy the piece back." "At a greater price than he paid. And how's that going to look if he takes it to law? Which I can tell you, he won't do." In the silence that followed, in the clinical blare of his work lamp, I was aware just how uncertain we both were to move forward. Popchick, napping on the folded towel that Hobie had set out for him between the clawed feet of a pier table, twitched and grumbled in his sleep. "I mean," said Hobie. He'd wiped the black off his hands, was reaching up for a brush with a sort of apparitional fixity, like a ghost intent upon his task. "The sales end has never been my bailiwick, you know that. But I've been in this business a long time. And sometimes," darting flick of the brush, "the edge between puffery and fraud is very cloudy indeed." I waited, uncertainly, my eyes on the japanned chest. It was a beauty, a prize for a retired sea captain's home in backwater Boston. Scrimshaw and cowrie shells, Old Testament samplers cross-stitched by unmarried sisters, the smell of whale oil burning in the evenings, the stillness of growing old. Hobie put down the brush again.
"Oh, Theo," he said half angrily, scrubbing at his forehead with the back of his hand and leaving a dark smudge. "Do you expect me to stand around and scold you? You lied to the fellow. You tried to put it right, but the fellow doesn't want to sell. What more can you do?"
"It's not the only piece."
"What?"
"I should never have done it," unable to meet his eye. "I did it first to pay the bills, to get us out from under, and then I guess... I mean, some of those pieces are amazing. They fooled me. They were just sitting out in storage." I suppose I'd been expecting incredulity, raised voices, outrage of sort. But it was worse. A blow-up I could have handled. Instead, he didn't say a word, only gazed at me with a sort of grieved fubsiness, haloed by his work lamp, tools arrayed on the walls behind him like Masonic icons. He let me tell him what I had to, and listened quietly while I did it. And when at last he spoke, his voice was quieter than usual, and without heat. "All right." He looked like a figure from an allegory, black-aproned carpenter mystic, half in shadow. "Okay. So how do you propose to deal with this?" This wasn't the response I'd anticipated. Dreading his anger, for Hobie, though good-natured and slow to wrath, definitely had a temper, I'd had all kinds of justifications and excuses prepared, but faced with his eerie composure, it was impossible to defend myself. "I'll do whatever you say." I hadn't felt so ashamed or humiliated since I was a kid. "It's my fault. I take full responsibility."
"Well, the pieces are out there."
He seemed to be figuring it out as he went along, half talking to himself.
"No one else has contacted you?"
"No."
"How long has it been going on?"
"Oh, 5 years at least."
"1 year? Two?"
He winced.
"Jesus." "No, no," he said hastily. "I'm just glad you were honest with me. But you'll just have to get busy, contact the clients, say you have doubts. You needn't go into the whole business, just say a question has arisen, provenance is suspect, and offer to buy the pieces back for what they paid. If they don't take you up on it, fine, you've offered. But if they do, you'll have to bite the bullet. Understand?"
"Right." What I didn't and couldn't say was that there wasn't enough money to reimburse even a quarter of the clients. We would be bankrupt in a day.
"You say pieces. Which pieces? How many?"
"I don't know."
"You don't know?"
"Well, I do, it's just that I..."
"Theo, please."
He was angry now. It was a relief.
"No more of this. Be straight with me."
"Well, I did the deals off the books. In cash. And, I mean, there's no way you could have known, even if you'd checked the ledgers."
"Theo, don't make me keep asking. How many pieces?"
"Oh," I sighed. "A dozen? Maybe?" I added when I saw the stunned look on Hobie's face. In truth, it was three times as many, but I was pretty sure that most of the people I'd rooked were too clueless to figure it out or too rich to care.
"Good God, Theo," said Hobie, after a dumbstruck silence. "A dozen pieces? Not at those prices. Not like the Affleck." "No, no," I said hastily, though in fact I'd sold some of the pieces for twice as much. "And none of our regulars."
That part, at least, was true.
"Who then?" "West Coast, movie people, tech people. Wall Street, too, but young guys, you know, hedgies, dumb money." "You have a list of the clients?"
"Not an actual list, but I..."
"Can you contact them?"
"Well, you see, it's complicated because I wasn't worried about the people who believed they'd unearthed genuine Sheraton at bargain prices and hurried away with their copies thinking they'd swizzled me. The old caveat emptor rule more than applied there. I'd never claimed those pieces were genuine. What worried me was the people I'd deliberately sold, deliberately lied to.
You didn't keep records?
No. But you have an idea. You can track them down.
More or less.
More or less. I don't know what that means. There are notes. Shipping forms. I can piece it together.
Can we afford to buy them all back?
Well, can we?
Yes or no?
There was no way I could tell him the truth, which was no. It's a stretch. Hobie rubbed his eye.
Well, stretch or no, we'll have to do it. No choice. Tighten our belts, even if it's rough for a while. Even if we let the taxes slide, because, he said when I kept looking at him, we can't have even one of these things out there purporting to be real.
Good God! He shook his head disbelievingly. How the hell did you do it?
They're not even good fakes. Some of the materials I used, anything I had to hand, cobbled together any which way.
Actually, truth was, Hobie's work had been good enough to fool some fairly serious collectors, though it probably wasn't a great idea to bring that up.
And you see, thing is, if one of the pieces you've sold as genuine is wrong, they're all wrong. Everything is called into question. Every stick of furniture that's ever gone out of this shop. I don't know if you've thought about that.
I had thought about it. Plenty. I had thought about it pretty much without stopping ever since the lunch with Lucius Reeve. He was quiet for so long that I started getting nervous, but he only sighed and rubbed his eyes, and then turned partly away, leaning back to his work again. I was silent, watching the glossy black line of his brush trace out a cherry bough. Everything was new now. Hobie and I had a corporation together, filed our taxes together. I was the executor of his will. Instead of moving out and getting my own apartment, I'd chosen to stay upstairs and pay him a scarcely token rent, a few $100 a month. Insofar as I had a home or a family, he was it. When I came downstairs and helped him with the gluing up, it wasn't so much because he actually needed me as for the pleasure of scrabbling for clamps and shouting at each other over the Mahler turned up loud. And in the evenings, when we sometimes wandered over to the White Horse for a drink and a club sandwich at the bar, it was very often for me the best time of the day.
Yes,
said Hobie, without turning from his work, aware that I was still standing at his back. I'm sorry. I didn't mean for it to go this far.
Theo, the brush stopped. You know it very well. A lot of people would be clapping you on the back right now. And I'll be straight with you, part of me feels the same way. Because honest to goodness, I don't know how you pulled off such a thing. Even Welty. Welty was like you. The clients loved him. He could sell anything. But even he used to have a devil of a time up there with the finer pieces. Real Hepplewhite, real Chippendale. Couldn't get rid of the stuff. And you up there unloading this junk for a fortune.
It's not junk, I said, glad to be telling the truth for once. A lot of the work is really good. It fooled me. I think because you did it yourself, you can't see it, how convincing it is.
Yes, but,
he paused, seemingly at a loss for words,
people who don't know furniture, it's hard to make them spend money on furniture.
I know. We had an important Drake Front highboy, Queen Anne, that during the lean days I'd tried despairingly to sell at the correct price, which on the low end was somewhere in the 200,000 range. It had been in the shop for years, but though some fair offers had come in recently, I'd turned them all down, simply because such an irreproachable piece, standing in the well-lighted entrance of the shop, shed such a flattering glow on the frauds buried in back.
Theo, you're a marvel. You're a genius at what you do, no question about it.
But, his tone was uncertain again, I could sense him trying to feel his way forward.
Well, I mean, dealers live by their reputations. It's the honor system. Nothing you don't know. Word gets around, so I mean...
Dipping his brush, peering myopically at the chest.
Fraud's hard to prove. But if you don't take care of this, it's a pretty sure thing that this will pop back and bite us somewhere down the road.
His hand was steady. The line of his brush didn't waver.
A heavily restored piece. Forget about blacklight. You'd be surprised. Someone moves it to a brightly lit room. Even the camera picks up differences in grain that you'd never spot with the naked eye. As soon as someone has one of these pieces photographed, or God forbid decides to put it up at Christie's or Sotheby's in an important Americana sale.
There was silence, which, as it swelled between us, grew more and more serious, unfillable.
Theo.
The brush stopped and then started again.
I'm not trying to make excuses for you, but don't think I don't know it. I'm the very person who put you in this position, turning you loose up there all on your own, expecting you to perform the miracle of the loaves and fishes. You are very young, yes,
he said curtly, turning halfway when I tried to interrupt.
You are, and you are very, very gifted at all the aspects of the business I don't care to deal with. And you have been so brilliant at getting us back in the black again that it has suited me very, very well to keep my head in the sand, as regards what goes on upstairs. So I'm as much to blame for this as you.
Hobie, I swear, I never...
Because...
He picked up the open bottle of paint, looked at the label as if he couldn't recall what it was for, put it down again.
Well... It was too good to be true, wasn't it? All this money pouring in. Wonderful to see. And did I inquire too closely? No. Don't think I don't know it. If you hadn't got busy with your flim-flam up there, we'd likely be renting this space right now and hunting for a new place to live. So look here. We'll start fresh. Wipe the board down. And take it as it comes. One piece at a time. That's all we can do.
Look, I want to make it plain. His calmness harrowed me. The responsibility is mine. If it comes down to that, I just want you to know.
Sure.
When he flicked his brush, his deftness was practiced and reflexive, weirdly unsettling.
Still and all, let's leave it for now, all right?
No, he said when I tried to say something else.
Please. I want you to take care of it, and I'll do what I can to help you if there's anything specific. But otherwise, I don't want to talk about it anymore. All right?
Outside, rain. It was clammy in the basement, an ugly subterranean chill. I stood watching him, not knowing what to do or say.
Please. I'm not angry. I just want to be getting on with this. It'll be all right. Now go upstairs, please, would you?
He said when I still stood there.
This is a tricky patch of work. I really need to concentrate if I don't want to make a hash of it.
17. Silently, I walked upstairs, steps creaking loudly, past the gauntlet of Pippa's pictures that I couldn't bear to look at. Going in, I'd thought to break the easy news first and then move along to the showstopper. But as dirty and disloyal as I felt, I couldn't do it. The less Hobie knew about the painting, the safer he would be. It was wrong on every level to drag him into it. Yet I wished there was someone I could talk to, someone I trusted. Every few years there seemed to be another news article about the missing masterworks, which, along with my goldfinch and two loaned Vanderasts, also included some valuable medieval pieces and a number of Egyptian antiquities. Scholars had written papers. There had even been books. It was mentioned as one of the 10 top art crimes on the FBI's website. Previously, I'd taken great comfort in the fact that most people assumed that whoever had made off with the Vanderasts from Gallery 29 and 30 had stolen my painting, too. Almost all the bodies in Gallery 32 had been concentrated near the collapsed doorway. According to investigators, there would have been 10 seconds, maybe even 30, before the lintel fell. Just time for a few people to make it out. The wreckage in Gallery 32 had been sifted through with white gloves and whisk brooms, with fanatic care. And while the frame of the Goldfinch had been found, intact, and had been hung empty on the wall of the Moritzhaus in The Hague, as a reminder of the irreplaceable loss of our cultural patrimony, no confirmed fragment of the painting itself, no splinter or antique nail fragment or chip of its distinctive lead-tin pigment had been found. But as it was painted on wood, there was a case to be made, and one blowhard celebrity historian to whom I was grateful had made it forcefully, that the Goldfinch had been knocked from its frame and into the rather large fire burning in the gift shop, the epicenter of the explosion. I had seen him in a PBS documentary, striding back and forth meaningfully in front of the empty frame in the Moritzhaus, fixing the camera with his powerful, media-savvy eye. That this tiny masterwork survived the powder explosion at Delft, only to meet its fate, centuries later, in another man-made explosion, is one of those stranger-than-life twists out of O. Henry or Guy de Maupassant. As for me, the official story, printed in a number of sources accepted as truth, was that I'd been rooms away from the Goldfinch when the bomb went off. Over the years, a number of writers had tried to interview me, and I'd turned them all away. But numerous people, eyewitnesses, had seen my mother in her last moments in Gallery 24, the beautiful, dark-haired woman in the satin trench coat, and many of these eyewitnesses placed me at her side. 4 adults and 3 children had died in Gallery 24, and in the public version of the story, the received version, I'd been just another of those bodies on the ground, knocked cold and overlooked in the hubbub. But Welty's ring was physical proof of my whereabouts. Luckily for me, Hobie didn't like to talk about Welty's death, but every now and then, not often, usually late at night when he'd had a few drinks, he was moved to reminisce.
Can you imagine how I felt? Isn't it a miracle that...
Someday, someone had been bound to make the connection. I'd always known it, and yet in my drugged-out fog I'd drifted along ignoring the danger for years. Maybe no one was paying attention. Maybe no one would ever know. I was sitting on the side of my bed, staring out the window onto 10th Street. People just getting off work, going out to dinner, shrill bursts of laughter. Fine, misty rain slanted in the white circle of streetlight just outside my window. Everything felt shaky and harsh. I wanted a pill badly, and I was just about to get up and make myself a drink when, just outside of the light, unusual for the coming and going traffic of the street, I noticed a figure standing unaccompanied and motionless in the rain. After half a minute passed, and still he stood there, I switched the lamp off and moved to the window. In an answering gesture, the silhouette moved well out of the streetlight, and though his features weren't plain in the dark, I got the idea of him well enough. High hunched shoulders, shortish legs and thick Irish torso, jeans and hoodie, heavy boots. For a while he stood motionless, a workmanly silhouette out of place on the street at that hour. Photo assistants and well-dressed couples, exhilarated college students heading out for dinner dates. Then he turned. He was walking away with a quick impatience. When he stepped forward into the next pool of light, I saw him reaching in his pockets, dialing a cell phone, head down, distracted. I let the curtain fall. I was pretty sure I was seeing things. In fact, I saw things all the time. Part of living in a modern city, this half-invisible grain of terror, disaster, jumping at car alarms, always expecting something to happen, the smell of smoke, the splash of broken glass. And yet, I wished I were 100% sure it was my imagination. Everything was dead quiet. The streetlight through the lace curtains cast spidery distortions on the walls. All the time, I'd known it was a mistake, keeping the painting. And still, I'd kept it. No good could come of keeping it. It wasn't even as if it had done me any good or given me any pleasure. Back in Las Vegas, I'd been able to look at it whenever I wanted, when I was sick or sleepy or sad. Early morning and the middle of the night. Autumn, summer, changing with weather and sun. It was one thing to see a painting in a museum, but to see it in all those lights and moods and seasons was to see it 1,000 different ways, and to keep it shut in the dark, a thing made of light that only lived in light, was wrong in more ways than I knew how to explain. More than wrong. It was crazy. I got a glass of ice from the kitchen, went to the sideboard and poured myself a vodka, came back to my room and got my iPhone from my jacket pocket, and, after reflexively dialing the first 3 digits of Jerome's beeper, hung up and dialed the barber's number instead. Etta answered.
Theo,
she said, sounding pleased, the kitchen television going in the background.
You calling for Catherine?
Only Kitsy's family and very close friends called her Kitsy. She was Catherine to everyone else.
Is she there? She'll be in after dinner. I know she was looking for you to call.
I couldn't help feeling pleased.
Will you tell her I phoned then? When are you coming back to see us?
Soon, I hope.
Is Platt around?
No, he's out too.
I'll be sure to tell him you called. Come back to see us soon, all right?
I hung up the phone and sat on the side of the bed, drinking my vodka. It was reassuring to know that I could call Platt if I needed to. Not about the painting. I didn't trust him as far as I could throw him with that. But insofar as dealing with Reeve about the chest, it was ominous that Reeve had said not a word about that. Yet what could he do? The more I thought about it, the more it seemed Reeve had overplayed his hand by confronting me so nakedly. What good was it going to do him to come after me for the furniture? What did he have to gain if I were arrested, the painting recovered, whisked out of his reach forever? If he wanted it, there was nothing for him to do but stand back and allow me to lead him to it. The only thing I had going for me, the only thing, was that Reeve didn't know where it was. He could hire whoever he wanted to tail me. But as long as I kept clear of the storage unit, there was no way he could track it down. Chapter 10. The Idiot. 1.
Oh, Theo,
said Kitsy one Friday afternoon, shortly before Christmas, plucking up one of my mother's emerald earrings and holding it to the light. We'd had a long lunch at Fred's, having spent all morning going around Tiffany's looking at silver and china patterns.
They're beautiful. It's just...
Her forehead wrinkled. Yes? It was 3. The restaurant was still chattering and crowded. When she'd gone to make a telephone call, I'd pulled the earrings from my pocket and laid them on the tablecloth.
Well, it's just... I wonder...
She puckered her eyebrows as if at a pair of shoes she wasn't quite sure she wanted to buy.
I mean, they're gorgeous. Thank you. But will they be quite right for the actual day?
Well, up to you, I said, reaching for my Bloody Mary and taking a large drink to conceal my surprise and annoyance.
Because emeralds...
She held an earring up to her ear, cutting her eyes thoughtfully to the side as she did it.
I adore them, but...
Holding it up again to sparkle in the diffuse luminance of the overheads.
Emeralds aren't really my stone. I think they may just seem a bit hard, you know? With white and my skin. Oh, Daniil, Mom can't wear green either.
Whatever you think.
Oh, now you're annoyed.
No, I'm not.
Yes, you are. I've hurt your feelings.
No, I'm just tired.
You seem in a really dire mood.
Please, Kitsy, I'm tired. We've been expending heroic effort searching for an apartment, a frustrating process which we'd borne in mostly good humor, although the bare spaces and empty rooms, haunted with other people's abandoned lives, kicked up, for me, a lot of ugly echoes from childhood. Moving boxes and kitchen smells, and shadowed bedrooms with the life gone out of them all. But more than this, pulsing throughout, a sort of ominous,
mechanical hum audible, apparently only to me, heavily breathing apprehensions, which the voices of the brokers, ringing cheerfully against the polished surfaces as they walked around, switching on the lights and pointing out the stainless steel appliances, did little to dispel. And why was this? Not every apartment we saw had been vacated for reasons of tragedy, as I somehow believed. The fact that I smelled divorce, bankruptcy, illness, and death in almost every space we viewed was clearly delusional. And besides, how could the troubles of these previous tenants, real or imagined, harm Kitsy or me?
"Don't lose heart," said Hobie, who, like me, was overly sensitive to the souls of rooms and objects, the emanations left by time. "Look on it as a job. Sorting through a box of fiddly bits. You'll turn up just the one, long as you grit your teeth and keep looking."
And he was right. I'd been a good sport throughout, as had she, powering through from open house to open house of gloomy pre-wars haunted by the ghosts of lonely old Jewish ladies and icy glass monstrosities I knew I could never live in without feeling I had sniper rifles trained on me from across the street. No one expected apartment hunting to be fun. In contrast, the prospect of walking over with Kitsy to set up our wedding registry at Tiffany's had seemed a pleasing diversion. Meeting with the registry consultant, pointing at what we liked and then wafting out hand in hand for a Christmas lunch. Instead, quite unexpectedly, I'd been knocked reeling by the stress of navigating one of the most crowded stores in Manhattan on a Friday close to Christmas, elevators packed, stairwells packed, flowing with shoals of tourists, holiday shoppers jostling five and six deep at the display cases to buy watches and scarves and handbags and carriage clocks and etiquette books and all kinds of extraneous merchandise in signature Robin's egg blue. We'd slogged round the fifth floor for hours, trailed by a bridal consultant who was working so hard to provide flawless service and assist us in making our choices with confidence that I couldn't help but feel a bit stalked.
"A china pattern should say to both of you, this is who we are as a couple. It's an important statement of your style."
While Kitsy flitted from setting to setting.
"The gold band. No, the blue. Wait, which was the first one? Is the octagonal too much?"
And the consultant chimed in with her helpful exegesis. Urban geometrics, romantic florals, timeless elegance, flamboyant flash. And even though I'd kept saying, "Sure, that one's fine, that one too, I'd be happy with either. Your decision, Kits." The consultant kept showing us more and more settings, clearly hoping to wheedle some firmer show of preference from me, gently explaining to me the fine points of each, the vermeil here, the hand-painted borders there, until I had been forced to bite my tongue to keep from saying what I really thought, that despite the craftsmanship, it made absolutely zero difference whether Kitsy chose the X pattern or the Y pattern, since as far as I was concerned, it was basically all the same. New, charmless, dead in hand, not to mention the expense. $800 for a made-yesterday plate? One plate? There were beautiful 18th-century sets to be had at a fraction of the price of this cold, bright, newly minted stuff.
"But you can't like all of it exactly the same. And yes, absolutely, I keep coming back to the deco," Kitsy said to our patiently hovering saleswoman. "But as much as I love it, it may not be quite right for us."
And then, to me,
"What are your thoughts?"
"Whatever you want. Any of them. Really," I said, shoving my hands in my pockets and looking away when still she stood blinking respectfully at me.
"You are looking very fidgety. I wish you'd tell me what you like."
"Yes, but..." I'd unboxed so much china from funeral sales and broken up households that there was something almost unspeakably sad about the pristine, gleaming displays with their tacit assurance that shiny new tableware promised an equally shiny and tragedy-free future.
"Chinois or Birds of the Nile? Do say, Theo. I know you must prefer one of the two. You can't go wrong with either. Both are fun and fancy. And this one is simple for every day, said the consultant helpfully.
Simple, obviously being in her mind a key word in dealing with overwhelmed and cranky grooms.
Really, really simple and neutral.
It seemed to be registry protocol that the groom should be allowed to select the casual china. I guess for all those Super Bowl parties I would be hosting with the guys, ha ha, while the formal wear should be left to the experts, the ladies. It's fine, I said, more curtly than I'd meant to, when I realized they were waiting for me to say something. Plain, white, modern earthenware wasn't something I could work up a lot of enthusiasm for, particularly when it went for $400 a plate. It made me think of the nice old Marimekko-clad ladies I sometimes went to see in the Ritz Tower, gravel-voiced, turban-wearing, panther-braceleted widows looking to move to Miami, their apartments filled with smoked glass and chromed steel furniture that, in the 70s, they'd purchased through their decorators for the price of good Queen Anne, but, I was responsible for telling them, reluctantly, had not held its value and could not be resold at even half what they'd bought it for.
China.
The bridal consultant traced the plate's edge with a neutrally manicured finger.
The way I like for my couples to think of fine silver, fine crystal and china, it's the end of the day ritual. It's wine, fun, family, togetherness. A set of fine china is a great way to put some permanent style and romance in your marriage.
Right, I said again, but the sentiment had appalled me, and the two Bloody Marys I'd had at Fred's had not wholly washed the taste of it away. Kitsy was looking at the earrings, doubtfully it seemed.
Well, look, I will wear them for the wedding. They're beautiful, and I know they were your mother's. I want you to wear what you want. I'll tell you what I think.
Playfully, she reached across the table and took my hand.
I think you need to have a nap.
Absolutely, I said, pressing her palm to my face, remembering how lucky I was. 2. It had happened really fast. Within 2 months of my dinner at the barber's, Kitsy and I were seeing each other every day, practically. Long walks and dinner, sometimes Paris Match or Le Bill Bouquet, sometimes sandwiches in the kitchen, and talking about old times, about Andy and rainy Sundays with the Monopoly board.
You two were so mean. It was like Shirley Temple against Henry Ford and J.P. Morgan.
About the night she'd cried when we made her watch Hellboy instead of Pocahontas, and our excruciating coat and tie nights, excruciating for the little boys anyway, sitting stiffly at the yacht club, Coca-Colas with lime, and Mr. Barber looking restlessly around the dining room for Amadeo, his favorite waiter, with whom he insisted on practicing his ridiculous Xavier Cugat Spanish. School friends, parties, always something to talk about. Do you remember this? Do you remember that? Remember when we... Not like Carol Lombard's, where it was all booze and bed, and not that much to say to each other. Not that Kitsy and I weren't different people as well, but that was all right. After all, as Hobie had pointed out sensibly enough, wasn't marriage supposed to be a union of opposites? Wasn't I supposed to bring new undertakings to her life, and she to mine? And besides, I told myself, wasn't it time to move forward, let go, turn from the garden that was locked to me, live in the present, focus on the now instead of grieving for what I could never have? For years I'd been wallowing in a hothouse of wasteful sorrow, Pippa, 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 exhilaration and despair. It was never ending. Incidents of virtually no significance threw me to the stars or plunged me into speechless depressions, her name on my phone, or an email signed Love, which was how Pippa signed all her emails to everyone, had me flying for days, whereas if, when phoning Hobie, she didn't ask to speak to me, and why should she, I was crushed beyond any reasonable prospect. I was deluded, and I knew it. Worse, my love for Pippa was muddied up below the waterline with my mother, with my mother's death, with losing my mother and not being able to get her back. All that blind, infantile hunger to save and be saved,
to repeat the past and make it different, had somehow attached itself ravenously to her. There was an instability in it, a sickness. I was seeing things that weren't there. I was only one step away from some trailer park loner stalking a girl he'd spotted in the mall. For the truth of it was, Pippa and I saw each other maybe twice a year. We emailed and texted, though with no great regularity. When she was in town, we loaned each other books and went to the movies. We were friends, nothing more. My hopes for a relationship with her were wholly unreal, whereas my ongoing misery and frustration were an all-too-horrible reality. Was groundless, hopeless, unrequited obsession any way to waste the rest of my life? It had been a conscious decision to pull free. It had taken everything I had to do it, like an animal gnawing a limb off to escape a trap. And somehow I had done it. And there on the other side was Kitsy, looking at me with the amused, gooseberry gray eyes. We had fun together. We got on. It was her first summer in the city, my whole life ever. The house in Maine was closed tight. Uncle Harry and the cousins had gone up to Canada to the Ile de la Madeleine.
And I'm a bit at loose ends here with Mom. And, oh, please do something with me. Won't you please go out to the beach with me this weekend?
So, on the weekends we went out to East Hampton, where we stayed in the house of friends of hers who were summering in France. And, during the week, we met downtown after I got off work, drinking tepid wine in sidewalk cafes, deserted Tribeca evenings with fever-hot sidewalks and hot wind from the subway grates blowing sparks from the end of my cigarette. Movie theaters were always cool, and the old King Cole room, and the Oyster Bar at Grand Central. 2 afternoons a week, hatted, gloved, in Jack Purcell's and tidy skirts, sprayed head to toe with medical-grade sunblock, for she, like Andy, was allergic to the sun. She drove out on her own to Shinnecock or Maidstone, in her black Mini Cooper, which had been specially fitted in the back to hold a set of golf clubs. Unlike Andy, she chattered and fluttered, laughed nervously and at her own jokes, with a ghost of her father's scattered energies, but without the disengaged quality, the irony. You could have powdered her and drawn a beauty mark on her face, and she might have been a lady-in-waiting at Versailles, with her white skin and pink cheeks, her stammering gaiety. She wore tiny linen shift dresses, country and city, accessorized by vintage crocodile bags of Gagas, and kept her name and address taped inside the crucifyingly high Christian Louboutins she teetered around in.
Hurdy-hurdy shoes.
In case she kicked them off to dance or swim and forgot where she'd left them. Silver shoes, embroidered shoes, ribboned and pointy-toed. $1,000 a pair.
Meanie pants,
she shouted down the stairwell when, 3 a.m., three sheets to the wind on rum and coke, I finally staggered down to catch a cab because I had to work the next day. She was the one who had asked me to marry. On our way to a party, Chanel number 19, baby blue dress. We'd stepped out on Park Avenue, both a little looped from cocktails upstairs, and the street lights had snapped on the moment we stepped out the door, and we'd stopped dead and looked at each other.
Did we do that?
The moment was so funny we both began laughing hysterically. It was like the light was pouring off us, like we could power up Park Avenue. And when Kitsy seized my hand and said,
"You know what I think we should do, Theo?"
I knew exactly what she was going to say.
"Should we?" "Yes, please. Don't you think? I think it would make Mom so happy."
We hadn't even firmed up the date. It kept getting changed due to the availability of the church, the availability of certain indispensable members of the party, someone else's cup race or due date or whatever. Hence, how the wedding seemed to be gearing up into quite such a big deal. Guest list of many hundreds, cost of many thousands, costumed and choreographed like a Broadway show. How this wedding seemed to be spiraling into such a production, I wasn't quite sure. Sometimes, I knew, the mother of the bride got blamed for out-of-control weddings, but in this case, anyway, you couldn't pin the rap on Mrs. Barber, who could scarcely be pried from her room and the embroidery basket, who never took phone calls and never accepted invitations, and never even went to the hairdresser anymore, she who had once had her hair done every other day without fail, a standing 11 a.m. appointment before lunching out.
"Won't Mom be pleased?"
Kitsy had whispered, jabbing me in the rib with her sharp little elbow as we